Speaking Freely, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation with one of this country's leading experts in constitutional law and civil liberties. Vincent Blossie of Columbia University is here to talk about freedom of speech in American culture.
Well, Wayne, by one measure, it's doing poorly. That is, it's probably more under challenge than it has been in a long, long time. There's probably more concern on the part of devotees of the First Amendment about its health than I've heard in quite a while. On the other hand, you might say that it's healthy in that it is being thought about more critically and carefully than has been true for a while. There was actually a risk that the values of the First Amendment would take on the character of cliches.
Vincent Blossie of Columbia University. He'll be back in just a moment to talk about free speech in American culture. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. The Free Speech Clause of the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution has been especially rich as a source of cultural rewards and occasional perils. Although, as Justice Holmes instructed, we can't yell fire in a crowded theater, we're free to sound off on just about any topic under the sun. Nevertheless, with the emergence of speech codes on American campuses, the call for prayer in our public schools, and the presence of porn on the Internet, critics from both the right and the left are debating the merits, adequacy, and limits of freedom of speech. With that as a backdrop, listen now as one of this country's leading experts in constitutional law offers an overview of freedom of speech in American culture. Vincent Blossie is a legal historian and professor of civil liberties at Columbia University. His books include studies of law and liberalism in the 1980s and of the Supreme Court under Chief Justice Warren Burger. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a book about the intellectual history of the ideas inherent in the First Amendment to the Constitution. Vincent Blossie begins his discussion from an historical perspective. He recalls the Wobblies, a radical labor organization that flourished around the turn of the century and that engaged in frequently violent strikes. Their activities in turn gave rise to a national debate about their right to hold meetings and to demonstrate. But the Wobblies had an unlikely defender in a wealthy California woman named Anita Whitney. I asked Vincent Blossie to explain.
Anita Whitney is one of my most favorite people who shows up in the reports of the U.S. Supreme Court. She had a case that prompted Justice Brandeis to write his most famous opinion about the freedom of speech. She was sympathetic to the claims of the Wobblies to be treated fairly in the court system. She was not in any sense a Wobbly or really sympathetic with their political agenda, but she was outraged by the way they were treated often. And so she raised money for their legal defense and argued in behalf of some of their constitutional claims. And she wound up incurring the wrath of the local authorities for some of her activities, raising bail money, for example, for Wobblies.
Did she ever go to jail in terms of First Amendment issues?
She did. She attended, she was a socialist. And when the Bolshevik Revolution prevailed in Russia, there was a great deal of discussion among socialists as should we align ourselves with the international communist movement or should we not. She joined the Communist Labor Party, argued for peaceful methods of change, was outvoted at their convention in which they endorsed revolutionary mass action. She stayed a member of the Communist Labor Party after that debate, and then she was prosecuted not for anything she said, but for simply being a member of an organization that was on record as favoring revolutionary change. She was then prosecuted, convicted, sent to jail. She claimed she had a First Amendment right to go to such a meeting, and that led to her famous case in the Supreme Court.
And how does Justice Brandeis enter the picture? We're going to come to a ruling,
yes,
an opinion that he registered here in the Supreme Court. How does he enter the picture?
Well, he concurred in the ruling of the Supreme Court upholding her conviction. He concurred not because he agreed with the majority of the court. The majority of the court said she did not have a First Amendment right to go to this kind of a meeting, that people who support revolutionary action, even if they don't advocate it or believe in it, but if they support it through their membership, can be punished. It's not a First Amendment right to go to these kinds of meetings. Justice Brandeis disagreed vehemently with that conclusion on a legal technicality relating to whether she had procedural standing to make the claim. He voted to uphold her conviction. But what's most important about his opinion is that he, in concurring and refusing to join the majority opinion, wrote what many people, myself included, regard as the greatest First Amendment opinion ever to come from a Supreme Court justice.
All right. Now, we need to be up front right here at the outset, Vince, that you, in your opinion, Justice Brandeis is one of your heroes, and you admire what he is doing in offering this opinion. Can you rehearse this for me? It's you say, for example, in this piece that you wrote for the William & Mary Law Review, that at the heart of it, we have three paragraphs where Justice Brandeis is making some claims about free speech in this country. What summarize this for me.
Well, these are three paragraphs that are at the heart of, say, any law student's study of the First Amendment. I've taught them for 25 years. Never have I written an article that I enjoyed writing more than that article, trying to essentially unpack those three paragraphs to really get at the root of Justice Brandeis's vision about the meaning of free speech. He says a number of things in those paragraphs, but I think what is perhaps most important is that he identifies the commitment to free speech with the virtue of courage. What he says is that a society that commits itself to free speech is necessarily, by that very gesture, a society that is opting for confidence, for the belief that the way you deal with dangerous ideas is to answer them, is to understand them, to contend with them, and not try to squelch them. That it is the very function of free speech to free persons from what he calls the bondage of irrational fears. He was someone who admired, among others, the ancient Greeks, and his thinking about the First Amendment is much more concerned with character, with, you know, what kind of people do we want to be? And he thought the best reason to have free speech is because of the kind of people it will make us. It will help us to be people who are not afraid of ideas.
He, in referring to the Greeks, he says, for example, that you have, is it Brandeis himself or is it in the Greek literature, that you have a couple of personalities at work, people who are willing to sort of sit with the status quo and not take chances, and then on the other hand, people who deliberately go out and stir up the waters with ideas that may appear to be subversive or seditious or dangerous, and in effect says that's a good thing to do, that mm-hmm. we need to take these chances, to come back to a point that you made a moment ago.
Well, he does say that. He quotes or paraphrases Pericles' famous funeral oration reported in Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War, in which Pericles is describing what makes the Athenians successful and special, and Pericles claims it's that we trust our citizens. They're energetic, they're vibrant, they think for themselves, they have this kind of energy. And that's something that meant a lot to Brandeis, not just in talking about free speech, but in talking about his vision of the economy. Many people questioned some of his political commitments because they thought they were quixotic, not likely to bear fruit. And he said that you've got to try, you've got to engage, you just have to participate in the events of your day.
He also makes a distinction. Help me unpack this, Vince. Is it you making the distinction, or is it Brandeis himself drawing a difference between the men who set up the United States of America, and then the revolutionary spirit that contributed to the political founding of this country? What is the difference there?
Well, what he's essentially saying, I think, is that there's a tendency in these free speech disputes to be very fearful of revolutionaries, particularly when Brandeis was writing. There was an attitude widespread in the country that these people are not playing by the rules of American democracy, that what is notable about this country is that it provides for peaceful methods of change, and that if you want to change the society, go to the ballot box, petition your government. These are people who are engaging in direct action, who are advocating various kind of revolutionary nostrums and the like. And what Brandeis does in this opinion is to remind us that the very people who wrote the First Amendment were revolutionaries. They themselves had fought a revolution. They weren't afraid of change, that what the First Amendment is all about is change, and it's this kind of courageous attitude. So that he had a very different attitude himself toward revolutionaries. Now, it may be partly because his parents met, interestingly, during a revolution. They were German Jews, and the revolution, the abortive revolution of 1848, was essentially where they met. And so that he may have learned this at the dinner table. But in any event, part of his whole understanding of the First Amendment is to be more understanding of revolutionary idealism, if we want to call it that, than most of the people he was arguing against.
Is this the place, Vince Blasi, to trot out the old line about Thomas Jefferson saying, we need a revolution every couple of generations? As a legal scholar, how do you interpret that kind of sentiment?
Well, the way I would interpret it is as follows, that Jefferson, when he said that, was arguing against what we might call constitutional idolatry, that we shouldn't view the Constitution as the sort of permanent statement of what the country is all about, that we should view it as something that will serve us for a time, but that we should always be alert to how it might be improved or even perhaps replaced.
Is this, in other words, your take on the continuing issue of getting back into the minds, so to speak, of the founding fathers of the United States? How do we figure out what these men meant when they handed us this document, and how in turn we apply it to our contemporary cultural and legal questions?
Well, that for me is a very important point, because I don't want to get into their minds in the spirit of trying to view them as authorities. And I think that's exactly what Brandeis himself was arguing against, that you don't want to look at the Constitution as an authoritative document in the sense that it squelches further thought, that it has a kind of textual authority that you bow before. And I think that he kept in many settings reminding people that the framers were not people who were lawgivers in the sense that they were trying to control the future in a sharply prescriptive way. They were participants. They understood the flow of political life, and that we should view the Constitution in that way, as a process, more than as the sort of repository of political wisdom. And I think that was very important to Brandeis. It's essentially a dynamic understanding of the Constitution, and I think that's how he liked to view Jefferson. Incidentally, shortly after he wrote this Whitney opinion, he took a trip to Monticello, the first time he'd been there, and he had not held out Jefferson as a great hero of his early in his life, but by this time he came greatly to admire Jefferson, read several biographies, and wrote rather effusive letters to his family from Charlottesville on what a moving experience it was to visit Jefferson's home and the like.
What was to come back to Anita Whitney, what was the final disposition on that case? We've been discussing Justice Brandeis's opinion about this woman's activities with the Wobblies and the labor movement. Did he, in effect, spring her from jail or acquit her before the eyes of the country? What?
In effect, he did. It's interesting, though. He lost in the Supreme Court. His opinion was a minority opinion. The majority of the court upheld her conviction, and she lost her case and did not win her First Amendment claim. But the governor of California read Brandeis's opinion and was so moved by it that he gave Whitney a pardon. And so she was free and back out on the street engaging in her political activities, and she was arrested in one demonstration, I think at age 84. Quite a remarkable woman.
Absolutely. Vince Blasi, let's talk about First Amendment issues in generalities more than specifics of legal cases that are in the headlines here in the 1990s. You say, for instance, that the First Amendment is under attack. Who's doing the attacking, and what in our culture is at stake?
Well, interestingly, in the current era, most of the challenge to the First Amendment has come from the political left rather than the political right.
And that's a surprise, isn't it, after a fashion?
It is a surprise. It's not unprecedented. Most of us remember the McCarthy era as the last great challenge to the principle of free speech, and there, of course, the challenge was from the right. But throughout American history, the left has had its misgivings about free speech, as well as the right. But that seems to be where it is coming from today. A lot of it, ironically, comes in within university campuses, with the last place you would think that people would doubt the importance of free speech. But many efforts to, in one way or another, sanction speech that is thought to be insufficiently respectful of people from different perspectives and so on.
And the effort here is to enforce what? An atmosphere in which, how can we put this? Nobody gets his feelings hurt, where we do not have the threat of what you or I or somebody, as a student in a university might find offensive. And on that rationale, we say certain forms of speech are out the window. You can't engage in them on campus.
Well, I want to be fair to the people who are seeking to regulate speech, because their arguments are, as you might expect coming from academics, fairly complicated. They're not simply, they don't simply take the form, I'm offended, therefore, you can't speak because you're going to offend me. The claim essentially is that expression of certain attitudes creates an environment. It's an environment that can be very hostile to the whole learning endeavor. In addition, the use of language and essentially making a culture or constructing a culture is a form of power. And we're going to fight this as a contest of power, and therefore people who express certain kinds of attitudes are reinforcing cultural stereotypes or continuing to put down persons who have been put down too much in the past. So it's not just simply conducted in the language of don't offend me.
Uh-huh. Well, now, I want you to be utterly anecdotal, and I want to get personal here with you, Vince. I mean, how do you come down on this? You teach civil liberties at Columbia University. Do we go back to Justice Brandeis and, the more speech, the better? How do you think about it?
No, I have a strong commitment to the view that we should trust free speech, that even if you take as your overriding goal, as in many ways I do in my own life, the improvement of the learning opportunities of persons who have gotten less than their fair share of opportunity and wealth in the past. I mean, I'm somebody who's done work in the civil rights movement all my life. My political sympathies have been with the very people who now seem to want to regulate speech. But it seems to me that what Brandeis said in this great opinion, and what earlier free speech theorists have said, going back to John Milton, is true, that the way in which you bring about progressive social change is not by censoring those who disagree with you. It's by having the courage to confront the very ideas that you find so hateful.
Now, you're the lawyer, Vince. I'm not. I'm not sure if I'm leading you off in a proper or an improper direction with the following question, but is speech action? There is a sentiment abroad today that if I say something to you that you don't like or find offensive or is hostile, that I have done something to you. This is a very big order, but I want you to briefly unpack it for me.
No, it's the perfect question, Wayne. It really is, for the following reason. So much of the current call to regulate speech on campus and elsewhere builds from the observation that the old saying, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me, is false.
Yeah.
People claim it to be a new insight derived from new methodologies that speech can cause harm.
Right.
Speech has consequences. And I think they falsely claim that the classical argument for free speech is based on a contrary assumption. And most of what I'm trying to do in my work here at the National Humanities Center is to demonstrate that historically the argument for free speech has never been based on the assumption that speech doesn't have consequences and can do no harm. Anybody who has any power of observation must concede that speech can often cause harm and sometimes serious harm. So that speech in that sense is an act. It is a exercise of power in one sense. It is an act that has consequences often. But I would claim it's a special kind of act, and we don't get very far in deciding whether we believe in free speech by simply observing that speech has consequences and therefore in some sense can be labeled an act.
Vince, let me ask you to consider this point. As a teacher of the law at Columbia University and somebody who interacts a lot with not only law students, but I take it undergraduates, where should we make the dividing line between teaching our students to be sensitive on the one hand and on the other creating an atmosphere in our educational system that really does encourage a vigorous and free exchange of words and ideas?
Boy, that is a challenge that I have wrestled with a lot, because I do believe what teaching is largely about is stimulating the curiosity and the independence of your students. I've worked very hard to try to teach classes in which, among other things, free speech itself wasn't seen as an orthodoxy. I mean, I go out of my way to reproduce articles written by persons who are skeptical about the principle of free speech, who challenge it both from the left and from the right. I mean, I give them readings by Stanley Fish, Robert Bork, and a whole range of people who've spoken about the First Amendment in terms different than I would speak about it. Teaching in a law school, it can be a very sensitive atmosphere when you're teaching issues like pornography. And again, I try very hard to give them a wide range of writings, the writings of Catherine MacKinnon, as well as the writings of various people who would defend the rights of pornographers. My own personal experience, to be honest, is that if you really bend over backward to be fair to opposing points of view and not grudging, I mean, I really work hard to bring out, say, Catherine MacKinnon's arguments that pornography ought to be regulated because it oppresses women in their strongest light, and then attack them with the strongest arguments against them. My experience has been that Columbia Law students have been relatively tolerant about, I haven't had the kinds of problems that I think a lot of other people report having in terms of students being hostile to challenging ideas.
And the final irony would be that you law professors yourselves are walking on thin ice or on shards of glass here, worrying about what you do in class and the way you present these issues. Am I right?
I will tell you that my year here at the National Humanities Center has alerted me to this as well, that the number of conversations I've been part of in which, you know, esteemed scholars have worried about can I assign this, and can we teach it this way? And there's a kind of mild fear about teaching materials in academia today that surprises me and worries me a great deal.
Vince Blasi, we're talking about your work as a legal scholar. Let me ask you to add a footnote to our conversation. What does campaign financing and campaign reform have to do with free speech? At first, that seems like a kind of an unlikely fit.
Well, it is the issue that perplexes more First Amendment scholars than any other issue I know. It comes up the following way. Many persons are alarmed at the way we finance our political campaigns. Money matters a great deal in who gets elected. Candidates for office spend a huge portion of their time raising money. There are worries about corruption. So one response might be to prohibit certain expenditures in political campaigns, put limits on how much money can be spent by a campaign, limits on how much money can be contributed, limits on what kinds of organizations can contribute money, and so forth. But those who oppose such laws say, well, the First Amendment comes into play here, because what we're doing by those laws is reducing the amount of speech in a political campaign. If we limit the resources available to candidates, that means they will have less opportunity to get their message across. And that has to be a matter of serious First Amendment concern, particularly because we're dealing here with political speech, perhaps of the purest form. Mm-hmm. To say that we're going to lose speech by candidates for office, that seems to be closer to the core concerns of the First Amendment than to say we're going to lose pornographic portrayals or something of the like. So then the question becomes, can you regulate campaign finance without violating the First Amendment?
And to make a long story short, where do you come down on this? What direction are you moving in as a legal scholar?
Well, I've avoided this issue for years because I thought it was so difficult. I've finally written on the subject just recently. And my view is that it matters a lot what reasons are invoked to justify the regulation of campaign finance. That is, if we can link certain campaign contributions with corruption, that seems a valid reason, that we're not regulating the contribution because we think it'll buy too much speech. We're regulating it because we think it'll buy too much influence. Hmm. If we are regulating the amount that can be spent in a campaign in order to prevent representatives from spending all their time raising money, if we say that we don't have representatives anymore because they're not available to discuss the issues and meet with constituents, they're out in Hollywood or New York raising money, it seems to me that is a reason for regulating campaign finance that does not encroach on First Amendment values. We're not saying there's too much speech here, or too many, the wrong people are getting to speak, or the messages are distorting, or the electorate's overwhelmed. So I think the reasons matter a lot, and I think if we're regulating campaign finance in order to protect the time of candidates, it's permissible under the First Amendment.
Vincent Blasi teaches at Columbia University, where he serves as the Corliss Lamont Professor of Civil Liberties. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Vincent Blasi worked on a book about the intellectual history of the First Amendment. Stay tuned for information about writing for an audio cassette of this discussion. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was Vincent Blasi of Columbia University. For an audio tape of this program, send $10 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 736. That's program number 736. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Next week on Soundings, another segment of New Southerners, our continuing series highlighting the work of contemporary Southern writers. South Carolina writer Josephine Humphreys will be here to talk about and read from two of her books, Rich in Love and The Fireman's Fair. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program came from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.